Hello and welcome to episode 66 of the Desi Outsiders podcast. I'm Ankita.
And I'm Meenal.
And this week, we're delighted to bring you one of the most inspiring stories you will hear on this podcast. Our guest, Malvika Iyer, was just 13 when a grenade blast in her own bedroom in Bikaner almost killed her. She immediately lost both her hands, her feet were completely disfigured, she suffered from 80% blood loss, and her BP was zero. Doctors were not sure if she'd survive, and once she survived, they were not sure if she'd ever walk again in her life.
18 months later, Malvika bagged a state rank for her 10th board exams that she only prepared for 3 months. A little over a decade later, she walked the ramp as a showstopper for a fashion show, and just a few months ago, she was awarded a PhD and the prestigious Nari Puraskar Award on Women's Day. So, without further ado, let's jump right into the show.
Welcome to the show, Malvika. This interview has been 8 months in the making. In fact, our listeners might find it interesting that we're recording this on 10th April, and it was on 9th August 2017 that we first got in touch with you. So now that you're finally here, now that it's finally happening, you know, I can't thank you enough for joining us today.
Thank you so much. I'm finally very excited to be here, and I just can't wait for our session to begin.
So as they say, Malvika, great things take time, and I'm sure this time our listeners will also feel this by the end of this interview, and I'm very, very certain that the wait will totally be worth it.
Definitely. So I've heard a lot of your recordings, and I'm really excited about mine as well.
Great. I hope you heard the recent ones, Malvika, and not from season one.
Let me check.
No, it's okay. Well, let's just say that we're not very proud of our very beginning episodes, and hopefully you heard the good ones, which we just released a few weeks ago.
Definitely. I did remember the couple of people from the youth group that you had interviewed, so Kirti and a couple of more people. So those were absolutely fantastic.
Okay, that's fine. Then we're happy with that, Malvika.
So, Malvika, Meenal and I have read about you extensively, and I'm sure that most of the people tuning in today already know who Malvika Iyer is. But for those of our listeners who are hearing about you for the first time, I think it's important to go back to that dreadful day, May 26, 2002, when your life changed forever. So do you mind telling or sharing that story with everyone?
Definitely. I would love to. So like you said, May 26, 2002, I was 13 years old at that time, and I was in Rajasthan, it's a state in India, and I was in the city called Bikaner. It's a very, very colorful city. It's very famous for bhujia and very famous for the bandage clothes, and I have lived there for about 13 years, actually till my accident, and my whole family, I've lived there with my family, and I was born in Tamil Nadu, but then I did my school, and most of my childhood was spent in Bikaner, Rajasthan. And so I think about 6 months before my accident, there was an ammunition depot that had caught fire in our city. And in fact, we could see it from our terrace itself, because we used to live very close to that area. And the explosion caused a lot of grenade pieces and a lot of explosives to scatter all over the city. And that's how the particular shell, the grenade that I came in contact with, came near our place. And this was 26th May 2002 afternoon. It was a very hot summer afternoon, and I was actually during my summer holidays. I had finished my 8th grade and I was just entering my 9th grade. And I giving you a little bit of history about myself. I was a very naughty child. I was all about extracurricular activities and just nowhere near studies. That's something that I loved, dancing. I was a trained Kathak dancer. I had studied dancing for about 7-8 years. I loved running around, sports and skates and swimming, and I was most passionate about was art and craft. So I would love to go near collect used clothes or pieces of clothes from the nearby tailors and make something out of it, or collect waste and make something, a kind of a showpiece or something useful out of it. So that was my favorite thing to do. And so from being that kind of a very, very I had such an active and such an amazing childhood, And this accident that happened on that day afternoon, I lost both my hands to the accident, and more than the damage to my hands, both my legs were completely disfigured. The grenade exploded in my hands, and the one thing that I feel very lucky about it is nothing really happened to my face, which is very strange because I was facing the grenade. But then it's very strange when I reached the hospital and when my parents took me to the hospital, and the first question I remember asking my mother was, did something happen to my face? I don't know why I was so worried about my face. Anyway, I can only talk about the accident, you know, in a very candid way now, because it's been, I think, almost 15 years since the accident, more than 15 years since the accident happened. So I don't really recollect the pain, the physical, the emotional pain anymore. So I'm able to, you know, share it like, you know, it was just another incident. And I remember being, you know, taken to the hospital in my dad's friend's Jeep, you know, who were visiting my dad that day. And everyone at home, they thought that, you know, probably the TV or the AC, or, you know, no one really assumed the grenade would be near our place. So they all thought some electronic item must have exploded. So it took everyone a lot of time. And the room smelled very horrible. It was smoke and, you know, my blood and burnt flesh. So it was a very gory sight when my parents found me. And I had lost my hands instantly. My legs were dangling. One of my leg, my left leg, was almost upside down dangling. And no one noticed it because everyone was just seeing the hands. And I remember, although I had lost 80% of my blood and my BP was zero, I remember seeing my leg dangling upside down. And I told the uncle who was holding my leg that, please, you know, hold my leg, catch my leg, it's falling down. And that's when they noticed the injuries to my leg. I was somehow conscious throughout the day. They didn't operate on me because I would go in coma otherwise, because there was just too much blood loss. So that night, the doctors just asked my family and my friends to pray that, you know, I would survive. And luckily, I made that night. I did survive. And a lot of people gave, you know, I think it was just a blessing. My mom, everyone's, you know, blessing, I would say, that I survived that night. And there definitely must have been a reason for me to survive that night. And the next day was when, you know, the main story starts. And after about 3 days, I experienced pain for the first time because my body was in a state of shock. And when it just finally, the pain hit me, the next 3 months that followed the accident, they were trying to save my legs, and there was a lot of carpentry work done. They took, you know, skin grafting, bone grafting, and they removed skin from here, from there. So I think I don't want to go into detail all of that, but it was just a very, very painful time. I remember giving up a lot during those times. I even wished for death during those times because I just couldn't take the pain. I mean, I was 13 and I just didn't understand that why would someone have to go through so much pain. And I didn't really understand. The only thing at that time I trusted was my parents, especially my mother. I knew that, you know, she will take me out of it. She will bring me out of it. My family was very, very supportive throughout. No one really, you know, cried or, you know, felt bad or did any kind of, you know, showed any kind of sadness in front of me. Everyone was usually very positive, and I think that really helped me. And I just trusted my family, that I thought that maybe they will help me get out of this. And, you know, I didn't know really what the plan was, or whether I'll be able to walk, or, you know, and the damage to my hands, like whether or not will I even be able to do anything anymore, because at that time no one really knew anyone who had that kind of a disability, and we didn't really know that, you know, what was our next game plan. But then I think we just had the trust. My mom, she was very, very strong. And my whole family was very, very supportive the next 2 years that followed, because I was bedridden for the next 2 years. I had iron rods in my legs, and I had to wait for, I think I almost underwent 13 surgeries to get back on my feet. And I was taken to Chennai. It's in Tamil Nadu, the city where I was operated. And I think after almost 1.5 years of my accident, I finally took my first step. And I would say that, you know, no one thought that day would ever come, that I would even be able to walk, but I did. And I remember at that time, the biggest aim of my life was to be able to, you know, climb staircases. And I had simple goals at that time, to be able to hold a pen tied to my stump with a rubber band and to be able to write. So I had these little goals at that time. And every time I would accomplish something, I would feel very great about myself. And the first time I was able to fix the pen in my hand, I wrote to my friend back in Tikaner when I was in Chennai. And I wrote a letter to her with a very big font because I couldn't write like I used to write before. And she was telling that, you know, it's just 3 months to go and we are all appearing for our 10th standard exams. And that's when I thought that, you know, I felt a little bad that, you know, all my friends, everyone's life is, you know, moving, like it's just going on. And here I am stuck in the hospital bed and, you know, I am just surrounded by, you know, doctors and medicines all the time. So I think that's when I realized that, you know, there's something more for me out there. And I don't think my life is just going to be about, you know, trying to just, you know, being stuck in the bed. So, yes, so this is what happened.
But Malvika, just quickly going back to May 26th itself, you explained how a piece of the grenade ended up in your garage, in your house. But how did you come in contact with it and what actually happened? The reason I'm asking you this is that one person who's been really waiting to listen to your story is my mom. And for her, who has a daughter pretty much your age, to think that a 13-year-old went through this. And how did this even come about? You were just living your life. You were just going about your daily routine. How did this happen?
So I have a very poetic response for this. I mean, it is something like it was meant to happen. I would say that this accident was just waiting to happen to me. And if not this way, there would have been some other way this accident or something else would have happened that would have changed my life. Because I honestly feel that because of this accident, the second life that I have been given, it's such a meaningful life that I'm living. And that's my poetic response to it. But the correct response to it would be, so like I said about the ammunition depot, the grenade fire, there were these pieces scattered all over the city. And that's how we live, very close to the area where the explosion happened. Like I told you, we could see the explosion from our terrace. And like I also highlighted the fact that I am into art and crafts and that is my passion. And that's what got me to this situation also. I was trying to stick my jeans. I was trying to get very creative and I wanted to hit, you know, I wanted something heavy to hit so that I could stick my jeans pocket and, you know, make it all better and jazzy again. And I was looking for something heavy to hit. And I was actually looking for a hammer. And I found this in my garage, the grenade. It was diffused. It looked diffused to me because it was empty from inside. And I just assumed that it would, you know, work. And it did. When the two times I hit it from the back, it did work. For some reason, for absolutely no, it was just not necessary for me to turn it to that pin area where probably the ammunition was. I had to turn it upside down. And I think that's when I say the poetic response comes in. See, I was meant to turn it. This whole accident was meant to happen. So, yeah.
And Malvika, you also mentioned that you had these sort of ideas in your head that it would have been easier for you to deal with death than actually dealing with the pain. And it's very clear that you were in a very unstable emotional state. And incidents such as these change people. And you have just said that you're very grateful for this change and it can change people for better or for the worse. You were only 13 when this happened. And you know, at that age, you're going through a lot of changes. You mentioned that you were in the eighth grade, so you're going through emotional changes. You're going through changes on your body, and, you know, kids are dealing with crazy hormones at that age. So I'm sure everyone has these basic teenage insecurities, but we know the person you've become today. But as a 13-year-old, how did you actually deal with this? You said that your parents played a big role, but what else was going through your head to sort of keep fighting and to keep surviving? Not even each day, but possibly even every hour.
Definitely. I don't talk about it a lot, but that was a very, very challenging time for me. And I think the first time I experienced it, the 2 years after the accident when I was bedridden, I don't think I really thought about it a lot because there was just too much pain every day, every second. So, you know, other than recovering in pain, there was really nothing much to think about. But when I said that I was writing the letter to my friend and I found out about how everyone back home is appearing for their exams, and I had almost turned 15 by the time, and everyone was writing their 10th grade, and it would mean if I did not write it in 4 months, it would mean that I would have to skip my 10th grade. And in India, 10th grade, you know, it's really important. It's a big step in your school life. So I thought that, you know, I will have to waste a year, academic year. And, you know, by the time, so I just was very upset about that. And I asked my mom, because we knew about a private coaching center near our house, which would enroll students who have completed their 8th, and I could study in 4 months and, you know, write my exams just like my friends would. But that would mean going to the coaching center in person, and I was not even walking a lot, so my mom literally had to carry me, and we had to use crutches or wheelchairs, and I didn't my prosthetic hands I had just bought, and I was still not very used to them again. So that was the first time when I got out of the house, when I was not surrounded by my family or my friends, because that was my first real experience to be around people my own age. And why this is very disturbing, because I remember when I used to visit hospitals during my surgery times during the first 2 years, and I was completely, I would say that I was terrified of hospital visits or when strangers would look at me, because I was completely made, you know, like an animal in the zoo. People would stare at me, or, you know, they would pass very, very insensitive comments about me. A lot of women, a lot of older women, they would, you know, talk about, like, they would say, you know, they would pity me, and they would pass very, very insensitive remarks that, you know, my life is over, or my future is very dark, and, you know, things like that. So that was the first time when I cried bitterly, and I felt very bad for myself that, oh, maybe really something like that has happened. Because in my family, I myself per se, we never realized something like that. But when people would talk like that about me is when I realized that did something like that really happen to me. And that's when I stopped going out completely, and I would request my parents to have, you know, closed cars, or, you know, place, or, you know, if they're taking me in a stretcher or a wheelchair, that cover my body so that they don't see my hands. And, you know, that was, it's just so sad that I was trying, you know, to cover up something that people were causing an inconvenience for me, and not just, you know, my physical pain. So not going out for those 2 years, and then finally when I decided to write my 10th, and I was determined to write it because I did not want to waste my year. And that was the first time as a teenage girl, I'm, you know, meeting people my age and meeting boys and girls my age, and it was very difficult. At that time, I won't say it is stupid now, but now I really do feel it is a stupid decision that I made. I decided to cover my hands with full sleeves clothes so that no one would notice my prosthetic hands or my stumps, so that I can avoid people staring at me. And I would cover my legs completely with layers. And I used to live in Chennai, and it's a very, very hot place. So I was extremely uncomfortable for the next 5-6 years. Just to please everyone around me, or to make sure that no one hurt me by asking me questions, I wore 5 layers of clothing to cover everything, just so that, you know, I would not feel bad about myself.
So we can't even imagine the physical trauma that you were going through, but Malvika, the mental trauma that you just described, it makes me wonder, did you have any psychiatric counseling or help to deal with everything that was happening at the time?
It's strange, because a trauma like this at such a young age, you know, it usually affects people a lot. But I never really, I mean, for some reason, my mother and I, we faced this together. We were like roommates from the day we went to the hospital. And, you know, we have been roommates for years. And we were there for each other always. We would share, if there were any complaints, or if there were any, you know, incidents that disappointed either of us, we would share it with each other. She was a friend. She was a roommate slash friend. She was not a mother at all. She never behaved like a mother. She just behaved like a friend who would understand everything that I went through, you know, like a 15-year-old or like a 17-year-old, whatever age that I was. And that's how she was to me. So it was very easy for me to have an adult who understood me, who I could trust, and at the same time, you know, who was there to watch me and, you know, take care of me. So I had a great relationship with my mother. And I think I would completely give it to her. It's her, I think she was perhaps, you know, my psychologist. She was the one who was there for me. So we never really needed anyone outside. We never really took help outside. We were there for each other. And whenever something disappointed us, I think we talked it out a lot. And we somehow had this bond. So, you know, everyone, as with people, when they would look at us, you know, we were a team. So whatever I achieved, so ever since I got my, when I wrote the 10th grade, I remember still what my mother said. So we had just 3 months to prepare. And my mother would take me everywhere, every time to the coaching center. She'll literally carry me. She'll get me these clothes stitched to cover my hands. So she was there, a part of all my, you know, plans, be it a success plan or be it a failure plan, but she was there. She was a part of me. And when I wrote, I was ready finally after 3 months of preparation to finally write my exams. The one thing she told me was that I don't care what the results are, and I really absolutely don't care whether you pass or fail. For me, your determination, the decision that you made that, you know, you will get out of the house and you will face your life and you will write those exams. So the first day, the first exam that which I wrote, I think that was the proudest moment for her. So the state rank I got, or my marks that I got, or every, you know, the media attention, everything I received post the achievement, I think my mom already gave me, you know, credit for just going there and writing my exams. So I think I really feel that that kind of parenting, the way she brought me up, has really helped me to cope up with my loss.
So Malvika, it's really great that you had your mother there to support you and to give you that counseling and these talks, as you said. I'm very aware that a lot of kids maybe who went through something similar to you, or who've been in situations where they needed counseling, probably don't receive it, mainly because just the way the system works in India, especially. I feel that as a doctor as well, hopefully going to be a doctor in the next few months, I feel that a lot of kids come to the hospital, and more than the medical treatment, more than the medicines and the actual drugs they need to recover, is a lot of psychological counseling they need to actually help with their recovery. My cousin went through an incident as well, where basically she walked straight through a glass door. And the glass got into her skin, and it was quite dangerous because it went in quite deep. And I remember when I was when all this happened, nobody really explained anything to her, or our family, or her mother, or her father. So they were just expected that the doctors would sort of fix it all up. But I believe that it's very important to make sure that if you have a patient, especially, you know, with something that you went through, it's really important to explain the process from start to finish and explain possible complications and possible outcomes. So did that happen in your case? I mean, what were the medical practitioners around you like? Did they explain the situation in a way that you would understand?
I completely agree with you. Mental health is a very, very important part of our life. And I know, I see it because now I work in the field, and I see that how, you know, asking for help is, you know, such a taboo. And I remember in my family, we, you know, asking for help, you know, we made it comfortable around us that, you know, there is nothing wrong to ask for help. But I do know that a lot of my extended family, my, you know, I've heard it from my friends that, you know, you immediately, like my physical disability, people immediately look down upon you that, you know, maybe there's something, in using, you know, jargons like crazy or, you know, words like that. So I think I completely, you know, understand that how, like, the importance of mental health. In my case, I think, so I always think of it because, you know, if the accident had happened to me now at this age, now that I'm in my late 20s, I think I may not have taken it the same way that I took it when I was a young girl. I still feel that, you know, I was very young when the accident happened, and maybe I was able to take in, I was able to accept better. And now I have troubles, or sometimes now when I go down, or now when I feel, you know, things are difficult, I definitely feel that, you know, I may need help to talk to someone. But for now, I have very supportive family, so I'm able to talk. But there are a lot of people, I know my own friends, who don't have supportive parents, and they are always lost. And I feel that it is very important to advocate for that. And coming back to my recovery time, I had very good doctors. Again, I was blessed with, you know, good doctors who would explain to me. You know, I was very curious as well. I think I was a very curious child, and I used to keep asking my doctors. I think after I crossed the first 3 months of pain, when the pain started reducing, and I just think that, you know, I would just talk to my doctors all the time. And the doctors, I think my doctors, that's their conclusion. Like, when there were a lot of people who had similar accidents like me, or, you know, who had, like, you know, lost an arm, or, you know, who were having severe injuries, but none of them were able to walk or show progress the way I did. So a lot of it, the doctors, you know, credited it to my state of mind and my willpower. Because there was this one incident when I wanted to, after my legs were healed, after almost 3 years of my accident, and my legs are completely disfigured. So there is like a lot of screws and nuts and bolts, and, you know, completely disfigured. And I wanted it to look a little bit presentable. So I finally, when I was able to walk 5 steps, I immediately had an idea that maybe I can, you know, have some kind of plastic surgery done. But that was just for, because the bones, things were like coming out of my legs. So I just wanted it to, you know, for my safety's sake, I wanted to go in for plastic surgery. And when I met the doctors there, the head of plastic surgery, when he looked at my, I had already been in his room, and he just looked at my leg and he said that, oh my God, the extent of this injury is too much. This person cannot even walk, and you want me to, you know, look for plastic surgery options. And that's when I told the doctor that I walked to your clinic and came. And then he said that, you know, you are walking with your mind. You're not actually walking with your legs. So I understood the importance of positive mind at that time, that, you know, I am actually, my recovery, the way I healed and the way I got out of everything was actually because of my state of mind, and not, it had nothing to do with the surgery or, you know, the how well or how bad the doctors did. So I think, like you're saying, it's very important to have the right kind of support. And especially, I mean, I'm sure, because if at all my mom, my family would have left me, or would have, you know, let me keep mingling with those people who kept, you know, pitying me. And, you know, I just cried for one day when those people looked at me, because after that, they never took me to that place. But not a lot of people do have that kind of awareness. And I know that my own mother never thought that, you know, what is my child going to do, or is she really, you know, disabled? So I really feel that I got very lucky in terms of getting this right kind of support. And I think that's what has helped me come out of it.
Malvika, from being in a position where you were told to your face that you can't walk anymore, you've come to a point now where you walk the ramp as a showstopper for a fashion show. So there it is. That's the mentality you were talking about.
Absolutely. I mean, it was, honestly, that was a very, very exciting moment. And I remember that I had to wear sneakers and, you know, proper medicated shoes, because I can't walk with good, like, you know, heels. But to be able to walk the ramp, and I was very proud of myself that day. And I think that, like you said, it's our mind, because till today, even now, I have problems with my leg. I still cannot walk, and I still, my legs hurt. Even if I walk for 5 minutes, my legs start hurting. I just don't say it out aloud. Otherwise, I would be complaining all the time that my legs are hurting. So I definitely feel that it is our strength, inner strength, that, you know, always helps us come out of any challenge.
Yeah, people always say mind over matter, and I think this is a perfect example. I don't think I've ever seen or heard of a more perfect example. When people say mind over matter, that's really incredible, Malvika. You spoke about the support your mother gave to you, and I wonder what it must have been like for your mother as well. I mean, your mother is seeing her own daughter in a, basically, I mean, when it happened, it was a bloodbath. And she didn't know what was going on. She wasn't sure what would be the future of her own daughter. So I'm sure she needed some sort of guidance and some sort of help, especially from the doctors, to tell her, like, okay, this is what we're going to do with your daughter. This is the procedure that's going to take place. At least to give her some sort of satisfaction that her daughter is in the right hands, I guess. Did your parents by any chance receive any support from anyone, or even any guidance from the doctors?
So I think I was initially treated in Rajasthan where the accident happened, and after about 1 year of my accident, there was not a lot of progress the way we expected. And my parents, my mother's family lives in Chennai, and that's when my mom was kind of, she was feeling a little restless because I was not showing any sign of progress. And after the doctors suggesting almost, I think, 7 months, my legs were plastered, and they said that, you know, after these so and so months, when they opened my then I will be able to walk. But then when they did remove, my leg was in a gory mess. Like, my leg was literally shaking, it was moving, and it was almost half rotten. So it was a very scary sight. And that's when my mom felt very helpless, and she thought that this was not, you know, going anywhere. And she called her parents back in Chennai, and she asked for their help, that, you know, I'm unable to, you know, there's just no progress at all, and we are unable to do anything. So that's when her parents, my mom, my grandparents, asked my mother that, you know, I should be brought to Chennai, and, you know, they'll help take care of me. And, you know, there are a lot of medical facilities here, so maybe that will help us. So I think when we moved to a metro city, there were less stairs comparatively. There was more progress in terms of, you know, the big picture was always there for with respect to all kind of treatment and plans and everything. People were more, you know, open-minded. So it really helped. And definitely that was the stage when we were given a lot of advice as well in terms of prosthetics and where to get them and, you know, how to go about the leg surgery and, you know, rehabilitation, everything. So I think it really helped to be in a place where there were more, you know, there was more awareness about the subject. And I think that's how she got the right kind of support there.
Yeah. And Malvika, some of the stats you gave regarding your incident really shocked me. And I discussed this with Ankita as well, because you have mentioned that you lost around 80% of blood. And according to medical textbooks, that's enough to get someone into a state of severe shock and even close to death, as you mentioned as well. So you did say that you couldn't feel anything for the first few hours and your first few days maybe, and the sensations only came back later. I cannot imagine, I don't think anybody can imagine the pain you must have been through. But considering that you've lost both of your hands, did you experience any sort of phantom pain? Do you feel, or did you feel that your hand was still parts of your body?
I feel that all the time, even right now, I feel it.
Oh.
So I think, especially when I move in extreme cold and hot climates, I'm unable to take care of my stump. And, you know, I feel that, you know, I feel it all the time. And it's something, it took time for me to understand that how I should cope with it. And I get pain in the parts that I still don't have. And I think like pain has become very, like, it's a part of my life now. So I really don't complain much, but I do. It did take me a lot of time to understand, you know, my new hands and how I'm going to be about it. And especially my right hand, I think you must have seen that PhD post where I talked about how I wrote the thesis, my PhD thesis, with my right stump. So there's a bone protruding out of my right stump. The best part about it is that bone, it was actually, the surgery was, there was some mistake with the surgery. So, you know, they joined both the bones of my hand to the point that I can't, like, you know, rotate my hand, the right hand. But then because of that pointy bone, it acts like my finger, like I type and, you know, I use all my gadgets and everything with that. But again, at the same time, I keep getting hurt because it's a protruding bone, so I keep getting hurt all the time. So, you know, pain is a part of my life, and I think if I start thinking about it, it's a never-ending subject.
But how do you deal with the phantom pain or just pain in general? I mean, do you have to take medications on a daily basis, and what medications do you take?
I don't take medications anymore. I mean, it's been a lot of years since I stopped taking painkillers. I don't have a choice. So if I walk for more than 5 minutes, or if I stand for more than 2 minutes continuously, my leg is going to hurt. So this is a part of my life. This has been there since the day of my accident, since the day I started walking till today. And With terms of my hand, if I overuse the right bone, if I type a lot, if I, you know, use it a lot, it hurts a lot. So I will not be able to use my hand itself for the next 3-4 days. And the phantom pain is a whole different story because I don't know yet how to, you know, control or do anything about it. So, and there are like a lot of muscles and tissues in my legs that are disfigured. So, you know, even that hurts and I'm still unable to track which is the nerve or which is the, you know, muscle that's hurting. So, see, again, like, you know, I survived the accident. I remember iron rods being drilled inside my leg and, you know, blood and all that everywhere. So I came out of that. A lot of amazing things happened after that. And I think it's just going to not take me anywhere if I start now and complain about my pain or not do anything because of my pain or stop myself from, you know, taking opportunities because of my pain. I know what will happen. Because then I'll be stuck to my bed, I'll be stuck to this room, and I will not be able to go outside and do anything or any do, achieve anything that I want to. So I don't have a choice, really. I mean, I do spend some days sulking and, you know, feeling bad for my pain. I do keep some days allotted for that because, you know, I can't be strong every day. But I know that I don't have a choice because the day I decide to, you know, think about the pain, that day it's like I've given up. So I really can't move forward from there.
And this resistance to not giving up is what got you out of your bed, got you to training classes and got you to write your 10th boards within just 3 months. So you passed out of your 8th, you were about to get into your 9th standard. All of your friends were going to write their board exams by the time you got out of the hospital after 18 months. But I want to ask you, Malvika, were you always a go-getter growing up? Were you always that kid who would have bagged that rank anyway?
I think I had great leadership skills. I think I was a go-getter in terms of, you know, if there was any duty to be performed or if there was an activity that out of the school or the group project or anything, someone needed me, I know that I was always there and I would help finish it. But not in terms of education, not in terms of studies. I was not the kind of student who would study and score great marks. I was an average student. I would get between 75-80%, not more than that, in my school. I was never a first ranker. I had never aimed to be a first ranker. My sister was the smart one and I never really wanted to be like her. And I think I was just the opposite of my sister. I was a very trouble, naughty child, but I definitely, I think the spirit, like my aunt used to say that, you know, when I was a young girl and I used to walk down the streets, when she used to take me for walks, I would just smile at everyone. Or, you know, if there was an activity that needed to be done in school, so during the PTA, when my mom would visit my teachers, they would say that she's always there. She's always going to help us get things done. And, you know, sometimes even the annoying kid, you know, who's always there to help the teacher, and you know, sometimes I was even that. I think I just loved doing a lot of things, and I really liked being interested in a lot of things and extracurricular and everything. So I definitely feel that some of that spirit I did bring it with me when the accident happened. In terms of scoring those marks, I definitely feel that, I mean, I think I was bedridden and I could not do, I loved a lot of things, and I literally one fine day, I just had to quit everything I loved, like dancing, crafts and everything. Everything I loved, I was just forced to quit it one fine day. And that's when I realized that, oh my God, I'm never going to be able to have a future in any of those things. And luckily for me, I was 15, so I didn't really probably understand its impact, that what I have lost. So I just started studying, I just started reading, and I realized that I can actually, you know, maybe if not that, then this. So as a young girl, I was able to accept the choice that, you know, if not A, then B, then, you know, it's not the end of life. So I just maybe took it very casually, I would say.
I feel like I jumped the gun a little bit because I've read up so much about you. I already know that after just 3 months or 4 months of preparation before your 10th boards, you went ahead, wrote those exams, and you got a state rank, and you got commended by Abdul Kalam himself, who was the president of India at the time. So for our listeners who had no idea, this is the context and this is what we were talking about. This is the rank I mentioned in the question earlier. But Malvika, I studied in India. I gave my board exams in India, and I know what those exams are like. So for anyone, again, who doesn't know, what the situation is like in India. These exams are considered to be, like Malvika mentioned, these exams are considered to be very important. There are complex math problems, there are detailed biology diagrams. So I think the appropriate word for what you did was practice more than study, because you must have practiced how to give perfect instructions to your scribe. And your scribe was a person who was writing the exam on your behalf because you had lost both your hands during the accident. So I want to know what the process of practicing to give instructions while also memorizing so many things, you know, what was that process like in just 3 months?
Yes, I think this is a very fascinating subject. I think this was the most challenging part of writing the exams, because we are so trained to think and write that not being able to think and write by yourself was, I think, a bigger challenge for me than, you know, anything. And I remember the first time that I had to dictate math and science and, you know, the diagrams, geometry and, you know, all like biology diagrams and, you know, fractions and everything. So I think it was very, very, first of all, it took me a lot of time to understand how would a person even dictate these things. And I started doing that. And then I realized that I just can't take my own sweet time and dictate. Even though I would be given extra time, it is still exhausting to dictate, like to talk for 3.5 hours and, you know, continuously give your answers. So I think how I started studying was, I think, I started developing a kind of photographic memory. I think all of this happened during the time I was bedridden, when I'll have a math book in front of me and my mind will, you know, beg me to, you know, practice it with your hand and, you know, write the thing with my hand so that I can write it. But I will not be able to. And it's not all the time that I will have someone next to me to practice. And anyway, in the end, the writer, the scribe is going to be a surprise for you. It's not like someone you know. So those times is when I, you know, realized that I have to learn this. And I started learning everything, and I started learning how to dictate, you know, difficult diagrams and maths. So I, after a point, a lot of these teachers, they shared it with my other teachers and my parents, that, you know, I would actually, you know, start dictating in a way that when I would recollect the answers from the books, I would actually know the page number or the paragraph, because the way I started learning, I kind of started developing a photographic memory, because I would know that it is in the book, in this page, in this paragraph. So, you know, I think that's what I gained out of it. And ever since I got that, my memory, I think, you know, when all your other skills are, you know, they are in one box and they are all locked up, I think a new skill comes up. So that's how I train myself. And I'm very glad I learned it and I trained myself, because the next, I think probably the next 10 to 12 years I spent dictating all my exams. Till my PhD, I have dictated all my exams. And by that time, I had completely trained myself that, you know, this is how it was very exhausting. My throat would hurt, and, you know, the next day again, I would have to dictate. But I was getting, it was a thrill in itself, you know, to be able to, like, sometimes it would surprise me as well that, you know, I would remember, if I will see a question, if I had seen it in a book, I would actually remember the page and the way it was written in the book. So, you know, I have developed a great skill, and I would say that it did come in good use.
And Malvika, there's something that we came across, and it's a quote from you said, before I knew it, I met Dr. Kalam, and the media really encouraged me. They highlighted my story in a positive light. Soon I joined regular school. I was hardworking. I had to be. And one thing that stood out to me, Anankita, was that you said that you had to be hardworking. And what do you mean by this? Did you feel at that age that you had to try and compensate for your physical loss?
I think, yes, I really feel I did, because I thought that I had already wasted a lot of years in the bed, and then the things I thought I was good at, I was not able to do it. I really was scared at one point that maybe if I don't study well as well, I might not even have any kind of future, because I won't be able to dance, I won't be able to do anything, you know, anything with my hands. So where does it leave me? And I think that's when I think I was trying to make up for the loss, and the things that people used to talk about me, even though I thought it did not affect me, I think it must have affected me, and it must have made me think that, you know, even if I don't even achieve this, maybe, you know, I will just be left out. But I don't think my family thought about me this way, because when I did get the state rank, when I did meet the president, they're very happy, but it's not like, you know, excitement that, oh, wow, you know, this is a great achievement, because they treated me equally throughout, that even if a failure happened, they were fine. And even if a great achievement happened, they were just cool. So I think that's what, again, got me back to being grounded, that to know that, you know, you don't really have to compensate or you have to prove yourself about something. But I do remember that I started off like that, because I did think that, you know, if I didn't even study, where will I even be? And like you said, our school system is such that, you know, we have to perform well all the time.
And this thing you mentioned about worrying for your future, and also a couple of times in this interview, we've touched upon the kind of language that other people have used around you when they approached you and your family after the incident. We read that some people said this tragedy was doubly tragic because you were a girl and now who would marry you? Things like that. So I think I know today how you and your family would respond to questions like that. But back then, when you were just a child, you were just 13, 14, 15 years old, and people were coming and saying things like that. How did you and your family respond to those questions?
I don't have a lot of memory of how I responded, but I remember being hurt a lot. But something I would tell you here, it still upsets me. Now, at least at that stage, I did not know anything about it. Now I'm an activist and I actually advocate for this. And you will think that I got a president award and I would not, you know, people would think that, okay, I may have achieved something in life. But no, I would walk on the road if I walk without my prosthetics. There will still be a lot of people who will look at me and their first reaction, without any doubt, would be, you know, to pity me. Now I'm able to, you know, talk back. I was not able to do it at that stage, because at that stage I would take it personally and I would feel bad about myself. I would probably even cry. I have cried a lot for that. Now I just don't understand why it still bothers me, but I think from my research, I have understood that, you know, the discriminatory attitude is perhaps the biggest barrier for people with disability, more than their own challenges, their own disability. And that is completely true, definitely very true in my case, because, you know, I just shared with you the difficulties and the challenges I face every day with my body. It does not bother me, it does not put me back in any way. But even now, this time, my recent visit, I was getting the award and I came back and I was flying back home, and I had a lot of people stare at me and then, oh my God, what happened? Oh, this is such a sad thing. And I mean, I know only those lines in our regional language, Hindi, but those were some very depressing lines. And I just wanted to scream, because now I have grown up. I just wanted to fight back. My mom requested me that I should not get upset. They are only asking out of concern, but I don't even think it's concern. We know when it is concern, we know when it is curiosity, and we know when it is just plain insensitive. I feel very angry now. I never felt angry earlier. Now I want to talk back. Now I want to tell them to stop saying that, because imagine if I had actually listened to them, who knows if I would have even come out of my trauma. And if they do the same thing to someone who's like me, in a situation like me, I know how much it hurts, and it still hurts me. I mean, I must have achieved, no matter what, it still bothers me. And I still want people to stop discriminating people based on their disability. And I feel that, you know, that is pretty much the goal of my life, that what I'm doing right now.
And Malvika, I'm sure a lot of people back then would, as Ankita mentioned, were saying about, you know, who would marry you, who would want to be with you, especially after the disfiguring trauma that you had. But now you're in a very happy relationship, and you did just say that you have the urge to talk back to people. So if you could go back now to those people who said these things to you, and now you're in a happy relationship, what would you say to them now?
So I guess that's my husband. My husband is a feminist, so he tells me that, you know, this is not the way he explains to me that how one must argue, and this is definitely not the right way to argue, by, you know, telling people that, see, this is what I am. But I do know that I think it's what I do. I think this should only make me, you know, I think I do get angry, but I believe that going back, I will have to sensitize people, educate people, because it's my duty as an activist, and not take it personally and get angry and scream at anyone. But my duty as an activist is to sensitize people. So every time I get angry, I try very hard to calm down and then explain to people. Because I remember this one time, there were these very little girls. They were, I think, 6 or 7 years old. And when they looked at my hand, and they were very shocked. And then they said that, oh my God, your life must be so sad. And she was a 7-year-old girl. And she thinks my life will be sad because I don't have hands. So I was very shocked that what must, you know, why would she think something like that? How, what can she even know at that age that, you know, my life would be sad because I don't have hands? And that's when I realized that there is no getting angry or, you know, screaming is not going to take me anywhere. And I explained to her my life, my accident, and what I'm doing right now. And I told her that, look, my life is very, very good, and it's meaningful, and I'm doing these things, and I've learned these things. And, you know, it may be hard, but it's not a sad life. And I remember, that's when I understood, when I explained to that girl that, you know, it is very important. I have done it for the past 5 years. That's what I'm doing. I'm sensitizing people, and I'm going and traveling and talking to people and explaining to them that, you know, how they should behave and what they should be doing. So I think my duty still remains the same, that I must always work towards, you know, sensitizing people. And everyone takes time to understand. And I think I have to, you know, wait when change happens, and I have to, you know, keep trying till people understand that, you know, what they are doing is wrong, and it is not fair to discriminate people based on their disability.
And so, Malvika, if for our listeners right now who are tuning in today, maybe they are surrounded by some people who have some disability, or they may come across someone who's disabled as well, and they may not know how to approach them. So how could you explain to our listeners, how do you think people should approach somebody who has a disability or someone who may seem different to other people?
So my PhD, my thesis was on this subject, attitude of, you know, young people towards differently abled. And I learned a lot from my research. The first thing I think I learned was our instant need to help people with disability. You know, it's your instant reaction when you see someone with a disability, you think that they may need help. So I have a lot of, I think I would not say they're suggestions, but I have these ideas that, you know, how we can promote more positive attitude. And I think media, like you are a great example of that you're promoting success stories. And I think that is the most important thing to sensitize people about disability. And for example, when you see someone on a wheelchair and you think that, you know, a lot of times people use the word wheelchair bound. So you're like, you know, restricting the person in a wheelchair, but actually a wheelchair is very liberating for the person. They are able to go places in a wheelchair. So they're actually not bound, they're liberated. So, you know, words like that. And a lot of words that we use that in our day-to-day lives, and the way we behave, the way we hesitate, the way we stare, the way we should not stare at anyone, no matter, it's not just for a person with disability, even, you know, it's in our mind to stare. And I think that is something that we must first focus upon. And a lot of things can change. I think that's what I do, because I believe that when I meet people, they understand that, you know, a person with disability is just like them. And that's what I feel, that, you know, the more and more contact we have with people with disability, and we should encourage that more, you know, and that's what inclusion comes in. You know, you include them in your schools, your colleges, your workplace. The more people get to know them, the more you understand that, you know, they are just like you. I think all these things will really help. And my aim at this point is to, you know, introduce a curriculum where we can, you know, teach young children. Because the girl I met, that's when I realized that, you know, our attitudes are formed at a very early age when we are young. And that's when we form these negative and positive attitudes towards feelings and situations and people. So I think that's where we have to target. And we have to target those young minds. And we need to tell them about, you know, disability, and, you know, why is it, it's not something wrong, or it's not something like a disease or something. So I think that's something what we all can do to sensitize everyone around us and treat a person with disability like you would treat anyone else and not just ask. I think people assume that people with disability are either, you know, just very sensitive because they get offended easily, or maybe, you know, they're just always angry because of their disability. This is a lot of, I think, preconceived notions about them. And I know that because I have seen it. But I feel that the more we interact, the more we listen to them, the more we see them, the more we talk to them, we will learn every day.
And along the same lines, Malvika, in your first TED talk in Chennai, when you mentioned that a part of the process of coming to terms with one's disability is to be okay with the humor surrounding it. And you even shared how when you say things like you want to take matters into your own hands, your mother gently reminds you that you don't have two hands. And when I heard that, I laughed. I laughed out loud. But immediately after I laughed, I felt so guilty for laughing because it just seems so inappropriate, because we live in a world where everyone is being scrutinized with the internet. We are being scrutinized for every single comment, joke that we make. So as a disabled person yourself, where do you personally draw the line when it comes to this kind of humor?
Yes, that's a little difficult, because I would want to entertain jokes around my hand and around my disability, because if we take everything very seriously, I think life would just be very, very sad. And humor has definitely helped me and my family cope up with the loss better. But I cannot really say, it is different for every person. I want to entertain humor because it's important for me, but at the same time, you know, those insensitive remarks I was talking about, that's, you know, when people, I think for me, more offensive is when, you know, your curiosity of, you know, just plain, like, you know, you're at a bus stop and your bus is yet to come and you see a person with a disability and you just ask them, oh, what, so were you born like this, or did it happen to you at some point in your life? Questions like that, I feel they are more offending, they are more offensive than humor. And I feel that's something what we should, you know, not entertain. And in terms of, I think, in the movies, yes, I think that's something very upsetting when we see in movies, you know, people with disability are made fun of. And I don't understand those jokes personally, when a person with disability is unable to do anything and, you know, people start laughing. And I take, like, if you, like I was telling you, if I have to put headphones on, it's going to take me at least 30 more seconds, or probably even one more minute than how long it takes you to do it. So laughing at someone's inability is sometimes, I think it's very insensitive. And I don't laugh at those jokes in movies. And I don't think, so I think we need to know if you're very comfortable, like I'm very comfortable with my mother. So I know that she does not mean harm. But there are, I think in movies especially, they do make fun of you voluntarily when you're a disabled person, you know. So I think that's when we need to know that, you know, it's not right to laugh at someone because they are not able to do something.
And Malviki, you've mentioned before that you called yourself a product of inclusion, and you say that you're here doing all the things that you're doing because society and the people around you have given you a chance, and you want every person who is also struggling with a disability to be given a similar chance. And despite everything that has worked out for you, is there maybe one thing or anything that you would like to change in your own case that perhaps could have made things easier for you?
I think a lot of when I was in school, in college for almost 5 years. Yeah, I think I studied for almost 10 years of my life, from my bachelor's till my PhD. I would say the institutions that provide facilities for people with disability, I think they are very difficult. And like, for example, if I have to get concession for something, or if I have to apply for a scribe, or if I have to get some kind of a benefit with regards to my disability, they are just more and more difficult. They are not actually easy. And there's a lot of paperwork involved that has really, really, you know, in a way, although I was not completely doing the task, my mother was, and she has been subjected to a lot of challenges because of that. So I would really wish that we had more transparent and more, you know, supportive systems where we could, you know, for a person with disability, so that, you know, they could get, at least they could get their work, because life is already challenging for us, and, you know, you are just adding more and more paperwork for the challenge, and I don't have to prove it to you every day that I can't write, so I need to have a certificate producing, you know, paperwork for everything. So I think I really wish that that was something easier, because I have faced a lot of difficulties because of that. And also in terms of access, in terms of accessibility of, like, you know, public spaces, public transportation. Luckily for me, my parents were able to support. We won't be able to go in cars, but at least we will be able to afford an auto. But it's very difficult for us to use public transportation because it is always not accessible. Trains especially were very difficult to use, and everything for that matter is very difficult to use. So in terms of access, staircases everywhere and not having ramps or elevators. So, you know, I think a lot needs to be done in that aspect as well. But more than anything, I would still always come back to attitude. I would still always come back to this. I have lived in a lot of places. I've lived in Delhi, I've lived in Chennai, and I've lived in Rajasthan. And I would really feel my life would have been definitely much more, you know, easier if people had not stared at me so much, or, you know, made me so uncomfortable about my disability. And I wish I had the freedom of just removing my prosthetics and running around and be myself in my skin and feel comfortable. But I was not. It took me how long? It took me from 2002 to 2016. I think almost 15 years, more than 15 years it took me to be able to accept my body and not think that if someone is staring at me, then let them. It's okay. You are fine. You are comfortable. It took me that long to remove my prosthetics, take a picture of me and post it online and, you know, be okay with it, or just walk on the road and be okay with it. It took me so long. I don't think I'm still 100% there, but I'm trying my best.
And you got awarded your PhD recently, and your doctoral thesis was on this very subject, the subject of stigmatization of people with disabilities and the inclusion of people with disabilities in everyday life. And this is especially interesting to me because I watched an interview from 2015 where you said that you were accumulating data in your research to prove all the various instances where a disabled person faces challenges in day-to-day life so that you can address these issues one by one. So now that you've done your research, you have your PhD, you have all the data, you know where the problem lies. What are you planning to do with all of this information?
Oh, there's just so much to do. So first thing that I said, that, you know, introducing a curriculum at school and college level, and, you know, sensitizing young minds about disability. And then I think most of the ideas that I have come back to promoting positive attitude. And, you know, first is an education curriculum, and then we move to media by promoting positive stories. We go to people and, you know, helping people understand that the more contact you have with people with disability, the better you understand them. And I think there are a lot of things that needs to be done, and I have understood it from my research that, you know, how and why these attitudes are formed and what we can actually do about it. So I feel that it's a very big project for me now that I have taken upon, and I'm doing it slowly. And I really hope that, you know, it does something, because for me, I'm going to start first with talking, because that's pretty much what I'm doing. I'm talking to people every day and, you know, understanding why they think like that, or, you know, why would they discriminate someone. So first was to understand, and now that I have, and I developed my own questionnaire for that, to use for my PhD research. And it was surprising to see that, you know, a lot of young people would not feel comfortable, you know, being with a person with disability, or, you know, having them share their workplace, or, you know, not, you know, keep feeling the need to, you know, behave uncomfortably in front of them. So I think the first we need to target those attitude. And nowadays I get a lot of messages, earlier, I mean from before time, and now I get a lot of messages from young people, from teenagers especially, and from school children, that, you know, they have started reading my story on the internet and newspaper, and they have started writing to me that, you know, they understand and life is not just about, you know, themselves, and they are just too preoccupied with their own lives, and there's so much more to life, and they want to give and they want to work towards, you know, giving something good to the world out there. So I'm very happy that, you know, a lot of young children are now able to understand, and they're such a young age. I don't think I was able to understand all these great things. So I feel that I'm having a lot of progress as an individual, whatever that I'm doing, because I get it in terms of feedback as messages from people, and they're endless. They're literally endless. Every day I read them, and I'm very happy that everyone is able to understand what I'm trying to, you know, say. So it's very important for me, and I'm very hopeful that we will have a time when, you know, these discriminatory attitudes, you know, go away.
And Malvika, you've also traveled to many countries to speak. What do you think of the system that's set in place for people with disabilities in countries like Norway and even Indonesia? So I'm sure there's a very big disparity, especially with the more developed countries. So what do you think the system in India can learn from these countries?
Yes, definitely. I think in terms of access, we can learn a lot, because accessibility has played a great role in these countries. I've seen that, you know, people who are using wheelchair, they are able to travel almost independently and, you know, travel on roads, and they're able to have these automatic gears, and it's more affordable for them. And, you know, I think prosthetics also, and in terms of public spaces being accessible, I think that is also something that we can learn. And I think more than anything, you know, people, we are a lot of people, our country especially, like we are just so many people. And I think if all of us first need to understand, if they accept this community and not, you know, consider it as a marginalized community, I think that's where we start. I still know there was this one person who sent me a very disturbing message that I only know of beggars who are disabled. I didn't really think that a celebrity could be disabled as well. So this message is very disturbing for me, because so this person actually thought that only beggars are disabled. So because that's,
yeah,
we only see people who are, you know, on railway stations or on platforms. We see a lot of differently abled individuals who are, you know, who are begging for money. And it's just sad that we are unable to give them, you know, the right kind of support and rehabilitation. And so they are the only ones who come in public. And so a lot of people with disability are still not outside and, you know, getting their rights and speaking outside. And, you know, they are not visible to the public eye. So when you see just a certain few, you just assume like that. So I think in terms of attitude, there is still a long way to go. And I think that's where we have to start.
Malvika, this has been such a fun chat. So we want to end this interview with a quote by you that made us go back and reflect on our own lives and how much we have persevered, how much more we can do. And this quote is, "I feel grateful that the blast gave me a way out of a life of mediocrity." So the last question to you, based off of this quote, is what would you say to any young listener who is going through a traumatic time in their life now for whatever reason?
I think the one and the most important thing I would want to say is never give up, because I think giving up is definitely the most comfortable and the most easiest thing to do. But we all have our challenges, big or small, and I think there is no way to justify that someone's challenges are bigger than yours. So there is just no comparison in that area. You have your own challenges and they are important and they are big for you. But don't give up, because I think the whole beauty of life lies in around the fact that how we face our situations, and it always changes us. And I feel that the challenges that I faced and the experiences that I had has only made me a better person. It has made me stronger. And I definitely feel that with every challenge that I go through in life, I learn something out of it. If you don't get what you want, for me, I never had a plan. I honestly did not plan this life. I honestly did not think that I would get a PhD someday, or I would, you know, get an award from the president someday. I just planned step by step, and I just took life as it came, just a day at that time, that's all. And I think it's very overwhelming to plan and to pressurize yourself with, you know, all these goals and, you know, to keep focusing on that. And then if you don't, you feel bad and then you feel like a failure. I think all of these are just, you know, there's so much to appreciate in life. And I think we should just take one day at a time. And that's what helped me, honestly, to get through all of this. And The most important thing, especially for a woman, I would say, which is where it was very important for me, is how we are forced, you know, to understand that, you know, we have to be perfect, or, you know, we have to be very beautiful, or, you know, we have to have perfect hands and legs and the right kind of weight and the right kind of color. Because honestly, I don't have the right kind of body, and I'm not even fair skinned. So probably I don't tick off any of the perfect body list. If I had really, you know, taken all of that in, and if I had felt inferior about my body, about my skin, about my disability, it would have really killed me. But I'm glad that I did not think of my external appearance at any point in life. And I always, you know, thought of what I was good at, and, you know, what I am capable of. And that made me shine, and that made me look good. And that's what I think is very important for us to not, you know, push ourselves to some labels that our society created. It's not even for us. It's not even made by us. So why should we succumb to labels that are not even created by us? So that would be my message. And I think for me, the most important lesson that I've learned from my mom would be the effort to achievement is more important than our achievement itself. Because she has still date, whatever I give, whatever hard work I do, or whatever I have given, the effort I've given for a task, is always more special than the achievement. You get something, you lose something, it does not matter. But you worked your best, you tried your best. So I think our effort is what makes us, and we always come out of it.
Well, thank you so much, Malvika, for your inspiring words. I'm sure a lot of our listeners will benefit from this interview, and I'm sure a lot of them would want to get in touch with you as well. So if they would like to get in touch with you, how could they go about that?
I am online everywhere. You can find me on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, I think by the name Malvika Iyer. And if there is any particular, I think I can share my email address with you as well, but I think you just Google my name, Malvika Iyer, I'll be there, and I read all messages I get, and if not immediately, definitely within a week or two, I get back to all the messages. So please write to me. That's the most favorite part of my day, to respond to people.
Oh, within 8 months you'll appear on the show.
Thank you so much for your time today, Malvika. It was a great honor to listen to you, and I'm sure you've inspired a lot of people out there. You've definitely inspired me today, and I kind of thank you enough for your time today.
Thank you so much. It was amazing talking to you, and I'm absolutely, it's just been a great afternoon for me.
Fantastic.
Thank you, Malvika. And thank you for tuning in as always, dear listeners. And if you enjoyed this episode, we'd be very grateful if you could leave us a review on iTunes so that more people like you would find our episodes and our show.
You can find Malvika on all social media platforms, including Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. And while you're on social media, don't forget to check us out at Desi Outsiders. We welcome all your feedback and all your comments also via email. You can find us at mail@desioutsiders.com. So until next week, I'm Meenal.
And I'm Ankita.
And we are the Desi Outsiders.